Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded version of No Limits, so we won't be able to take calls, emails, or messages via social media. We're going to be talking today with several writers. We're going to start with New York Times columnist David Brooks. We caught up with Brooks at the end of September when Christian Theological Seminary invited him and public media journalist and host Tavis Smiley to town to kick off an initiative to combat poverty.
I do think it has been more of a character election than any other I've covered. And that's in part because it's been less of an issues election than any other I've covered, but also because the character of both the candidates has been under intense scrutiny. And I'm not sure we've always discussed character in the right way. It tends to be reduced to scandal, to Benghazi or the Trump University. And so I'm not sure we've had a fully articulated definition of character, but it has been central. And I think that's properly so. I do think character is destiny. Mm-hmm. And as someone who's covered a bunch of presidents, the character of the president makes an immense difference to the nature of the administration.
You identify yourself as a conservative. How do you define conservatism?
Yeah, so to me, my intellectual godfather is a guy named Edmund Burke, who was the founder of modern conservatism. And he has a phrase that has been very central to my way of thinking, which is epistemological modesty. Mm-hmm. And epistemology is a study of what we can know, and modesty is modesty. And basically, the argument is the world is really complicated. And when you act on it, you're likely to act in ways you don't understand, on things too complex for you to understand. And therefore, you should proceed incrementally with respect for tradition and try to have constant change, but make it constant, incremental, and gradual change. And so I think that's the basis of traditional conservatism. And then I would throw in another hero of mine is Alexander Hamilton, who believed in using government, but only in limited ways, to give people social mobility and to allow them to become capitalists. And so that, I think, is the two pillars of American conservatism: a basic belief in meritocracy and a belief in gradual incremental change. A lot of the people who call themselves conservatives are not conservatives at all, they're radicals. And so if you look at Donald Trump, for example, the current Republican nominee, he's not conservative by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. He's a reactionary. He believes he has an extreme mentality, an apocalyptic mentality, and he believes in radical change. And that's not conservative, that's something else.
One of the problems we see in American life right now is that there is no longer any true conservative party.
Yeah.
And that is a problem not just for conservatives, but for all Americans, because there is a balancing act. Could you talk a little bit about the kind of costs we as a country, as a society, embrace because we don't have a true conservative party right now?
Well, two things leap to mind. One is, because if you go try to approach politics with some essence of humility, you realize most issues and most arguments are a competition between partial truths. And usually the Democrats have some piece of the truth and Republicans have some piece. And so the idea is to balance it and to try to find a balance that's right for this moment. So, for example, I'm a believer in the free market, for sure, I believe. And I believe in it for modest reasons. I think it's an organic, very dynamic, flexible thing that gives people chances to rise. It creates opportunities. And it gives us information. It's very flexible, so we can learn about the world by what works in the market and what doesn't. But we happen to have structural flaws in the market right now. Mm-hmm. And so that the productivity gains we've seen are not reflected in wages for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And large numbers of people are dropped out of the labor force. And so even though I'm suspicious of government because I'm suspicious of planning, I think an actual conservative would say, what's our context? I don't have some ideological devotion to cut taxes under all circumstances. It depends on what the circumstances are. And we're in a circumstance where we have to have government a lot more active in national life to give people the human capital so they can compete in a much more demanding information age economy. And I think the lack of we have one party that just doesn't believe in government at all, mm-hmm. and then another party which I think is hubristically inclined to interfere with private businesses way too much, more than government can do, and a party that would just give people the grounding to compete and become capitalists themselves, that party doesn't exist. And so I think there's just a void. And as a result, we're either getting involved in the marketplace in ways that really create some backward effects, or we're not doing it at all, and opportunity is limited as a result.
Here in Indiana, we're dealing with a situation that's not uncommon for the rest of the country, in that the jobless numbers keep dropping.
Right.
We're pretty close to functional full employment, yet the poverty rates aren't dropping. In fact, they're even increasing, which contradicts what has been, you know, classic thought that if you put people to work, poverty disappears. We're not seeing that right now. What would be, you know, operating with your conservative model, a way to deal with, A, would that be a concern in the first place to a classic conservative such as yourself?
Yeah.
And if it is, what should we do about it?
Yeah. I think, you know, there are two separate sorts of poverty I think we're seeing. We're seeing, especially in rural areas, just a poverty. We're seeing a lot of men just dropping out of the labor force. And so it used to be if you were a man especially, but also a woman in prime working age, 25 to 55, you were either unemployed and looking for work or working. But now we have 7 to 10 million people nationwide who are not unemployed. That is to say, they're not looking for work and they're not working. They're just resting on Social Security. They're just staying on the couch. They're not. They're just permanently out of the labor force. And it's among those people you see the high rates of opiate use. You see suicide rates spiking. You just see isolation. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you have areas of concentrated poverty where you have intergenerational poverty, where you've got a lot of single-parent homes. You've got high dropout rates. You've got a lot of adverse childhood experiences for kids who are in homes where there's a lot of disorganization and a lot of drugs, or there's violence, or there's just homelessness. And so basically we've, in these two different realms, both rural and urban, we've got large numbers of people who have become isolated. And to me, the essential challenge for our era right now is social isolation, the problem of isolation. There are just a lot of people falling through the cracks. And that's the number of people living alone is spiking from about 8% a generation ago to about 24%. The number of people who say they have no friends in the world is risen from 10% to 25%. The number of people who are committing suicide, which is a function of isolation, has started spiking in 1999 and is rising. And so to me, the core problem we face is just a fragmentation of the social fabric. And whatever the cause of the poverty, whether it's urban or rural, the answer is reweaving the social fabric.
When she's bothered to articulate it, Hillary Clinton's argument to some degree has been that we have to strengthen our connections to each other, the whole better together thing and all of that. Would your point of departure or disagreement with her be that government is not necessarily the vehicle to do that, or would you agree with her?
Yeah, I think government is part of the answer. It's unavoidable. I mean, there has to be. I would be more radical, frankly, about reforming Head Start, but I fully support what she thinks about early childhood education. I think spending money as earlier is better. I look at the problem is every individual life of poverty is different. And so one of the things you have to do is you just have to respect the poor and listen to them. And then the second thing you have to do is hopefully connect one person to another so there's a loving relationship. I know a guy named Bill Milliken who's been working in poverty for 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably about 70 now. And he has a saying, he says, people often ask me what program works.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I've been doing this for 50 years, and I've never seen a program change one life.
Mm-hmm.
What I have seen is relationships change a life. I've seen individual love between one person and another change a life. And so how do you set those up? And I think government has some role. And one of my favorite programs is the Harlem Children's Zone in New York City, where they don't know what causes poverty in a lot of different cases. So you just basically throw the kitchen sink at the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You take one neighborhood, you give them early childhood, you give them Boys and Girls Club, you give them charter schools, you give them wraparound programs, you give them nurse family partnerships. You just make the social fabric very dense. Now that's expensive and it's hard to scale. But I do think that's the only thing we can do, which is to try to densify the social fabric in one neighborhood after another.
Sounds like you're doing a lot of traveling and being focused on this. Is it going to be the subject to your next book?
Well, no. The focus of my next book is on intimacy and commitment making, not necessarily about poverty. I'm traveling because I wrote about 7 million columns in the early part of 2015, 2016.
Yeah.
saying Donald Trump would never be the Republican nominee.
You and a lot of other people.
I figured I should, maybe the life I was largely leading between Washington, New York, and New Haven was not maybe capturing the full flavor of America. And so I thought I should reintroduce myself to the country.
Why do you think Trump? What do you think is the reason that he has had such staying power? Yeah.
I think it's because the basic axis of our politics has changed. And that we used to have a government between right and left, or big government and small government, that since the Reagan era. But we no longer have that argument. The basic argument is between open and closed. And on one side, you have college-educated people, largely, who see the modern global economy, see the meritocracy, and basically see these forces as tailwinds at their back, pushing them toward opportunity. And they welcome opener immigration, more open trade, ethnic diversity. They like the pluralism. And then there's another group of people who see these forces as headwinds right in their blasting in their faces. And they want to close the borders or protect themselves. They want to close trade. They want traditional social mores. And they want a more closed, secure environment. And so to me, that's the axis of government. The axis of our arguments have changed, and Trump really understood that better than anybody else. And so in many ways, he's very big government and very intrusive. So he's not a traditional Republican in a lot of ways. But he is for closing in and building walls and trying to offer some security. And so a lot of people who just think the modern world is destroying their communities, he's their answer. And that doesn't mean they're not realistic about who he is. A lot of them think he's a complete blowhard. But they're saying, we need change. I'm willing to go with that guy because he's the only ticket.
Is it possible, when you talk of these two sides, is it possible for them to reconcile?
I think it is possible. I'm afraid we're headed toward a world with where political conflict and class conflict and racial conflict are all overlaying. And so the Trump movement is a very white movement, obviously, but it's also a very less educated movement. And it used to be the college-educated voters were very split Republican-Democrat. Now the college-educated swing to the Democratic Party, high school-educated swing to the Republican. And so we get a class war, a race war, and a partisan war all on top of each other. That's a very ugly prospect, and I think we're only at the beginning stages of that. And so I hope there's some way we can have an open society that does protect those who feel it blasting in their faces.
We've talked a lot about Trump, and it is appropriate that we do so because he is something we haven't seen in American history before, at least not at this level. What do you think is going to emerge post-Trump, whether he wins or loses?
I do think the Republican Party is not going back to what we used to think of as the Republican Party, free market, free trade, global interventionist. That party that we knew from Reagan, Goldwater, all the way up through George W. Bush, that's not coming back. And so I do think we're going to see a party that's much more protectionist, much less likely to get involved in wars abroad or be active internationally, much, much more anti-immigrant. And the problem with that, that's a party for 72-year-old white men in Florida. And it's a shrinking, it's an ever, ever, ever shrinking party. And the only way to me that party can survive is if it jumps the color line. If it takes less educated whites and makes an alliance and a coalition with less educated Latinos, less educated African Americans, and you really get a coalition of people who are not thriving in the modern economy. I think that's unlikely because no populist movement in this country's history has ever jumped the color line because there's so much racial baggage that comes along.
Thank you very much for your time. Really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was New York Times columnist David Brooks. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.